Welcome back, Hemingway listeners, to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things really excellently. Probably have a bit of a chit chat at the start of this episode about the chapter six of The American, but also just general chit chat, because there's been a lot of general chit chat in the subreddit. I want to say a big thank you to Simply Productive. Simply Productive, I really love this. Simply Productive put a post on the Hemingway List subreddit with the title "Keep and a Sane Discussion Thread." I really appreciate you making an effort to preserve my sanity. Tonight's episode, by the way, is brought to you by a decaf instant coffee. A coffee with no caffeine. Kind of a pointless drink when you think about it, but I just kind of wanted something. It's 3 a.m, so I'm not going to drink a real coffee. But I was up last night till 6 a.m. just sitting around. I am losing my mind. So I appreciate the sanity post, Simply Productive. Hey folks, in the interest of keeping this podcast coming, let's band together to reply to Anders' desire to talk to him in today's episode. Below, please comment on any of the following: books you're reading, movies or TV shows you're watching, video games you're grinding, along with ratings, general thoughts about your day, and about self-isolation, funny anecdotes. Thanks, friends. Thank you, Simply Productive. I really appreciate this effort. I don't think I'm the only one at the moment that needs to be kept sane. We're all, hopefully, in isolation at the moment. That's the plan. If you're not in isolation, be in isolation. There's so many people, even like I've got family members and stuff that are like, I'll do a little bit less work. I'm lucky enough to still be able to go out and do my job every day. And it's like a completely non-essential job. And they're interacting with multiple people during the day. And it's like, I don't know. And then, you know, they're kind of like, yeah, but if I don't, you know, I mean, I've got to keep the money coming in and all this. And it's like, I think this is bigger than keeping the money coming in at the moment, actually. I think that's not the top priority. If you miss a couple of mortgage payments, I don't think that really matters all that much at the end of the day. No one cares. No one's keeping track. I mean, you know, someone's keeping track. A bank, presumably. But just don't prioritize it. Stop going to work. You don't need to go to work when there's a pandemic. All right? It's that easy. But, you know, I don't know. It's a tough thing to get your mind around. Like, oh, I'm just not going to do my work. But who knows? I mean, I don't know. It's a weird thing. We're just sitting around doing nothing. How good sitting around doing nothing? Roadfarve says, I lost my copy of The American shortly after we started reading it, so I'm behind. I've been following along since the beginning. Normally don't have much to add to the conversation, but I do enjoy the podcast, so thanks, Ander, for making it. Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the thanks. Thanks for the thanks. Let's have a little thank party. It's crazy to think I've been listening for over 2 years now. I've been watching some classics this week. Goodfellas, Scott Pilgrim yesterday. I've already been playing Jedi Fallen Order. It's really good. Haven't played video games in about 6 years, so for me, it gets a 10-star rating. Now to go looking for that damn book again. Simply Productive did chime in to say that you can get it on Gutenberg. I'm reading the Gutenberg one. It's completely free. Just jump on your web browser. So watching classics, it's interesting to see that Scott Pilgrim is considered a classic. That seems like such a modern movie to me. Like, that feels like a recent movie, but it's probably like, I don't know, how old's that? Probably like 15 years or something. I'm going to look it up and then I'm going to be mortified at how old it is. Let's have a look here. It came out 2010. Okay, it's 10 years old. It's 10 years old. That's not too bad. That's not too bad. I was preparing myself for it to say, you know, it came out in 2003 or something, and I'm an ancient person. Still, 10 years is a long time for a movie that feels so recent. Playing that Star Wars Jedi Fallen Order game, that sounds pretty good. I'm playing Apex Legends. Just, it's a very social game. You jump in a squad. You know, I've got buddies that play with me, and so it's nice to be able to chat to them on Discord and stuff. There is the Hemingway List Discord server, by the way. You'll find a link to it in the sidebar if you're on Discord. Do that. It doesn't get much love. I don't really think anyone frequents it, but hey, now's a good time to get back into the old Discord and have a little chit-chat on there. X Maury says, I am perpetually behind on the podcast, so I never participate in live discussions about the books, but I can help on this one. I still haven't finished Red Dead Redemption 2, so I'm getting my way through that finally. It's a great game. There are tons of side quests, though. Reading The Jungle Book for the first time. Oh, damn. I don't think I've ever read that. But I did play Red Dead Redemption 2. That was a great game. J Mama says, I fell off after Anna Karenina was done. Not sure if I'll catch up with the American. Currently reading War and Peace, as well as working through a backlog of video games. Hoping everyone in the sub is staying safe. Hang in there, Ander. I am hanging in there. What am I saying? Oh, rereading War and Peace. That's a good thing to do. I today had a little tinker with the Bogan War and Peace translation. You know, I got a bit of time on my hands, so do a bit of Bogan War and Peace translating. It also keeps my spirits up. I think I'm starting to get, like, I don't know, glum is what I'm getting. I keep having really sad thoughts. Like, my day is still characteristically pretty chipper. It's weird, like, my hours have gone completely out the window. But I do occasionally, today I did, just have the occasional, like, sad thought where I was like, oh, the world sucks now. but yeah, other than that, 99% okay mood. Simply Productive says, The American is really good so far, but the podcast length has almost tripled. Yeah, it has, and tonight's one will be even longer because I'm reading through this before I'm even getting to the discussion, before I'm even getting to the reading, but that's okay. Who cares? What else I got to do? I listen to Ander, get to the reading, and then nope out. Sorry, Ander. As reading the chapters takes me about 10 minutes, but closer to 30 over podcast. Yeah, oh wow, am I that slow of a reader? One third of the speed. I suppose it does take a bit longer to read out loud, doesn't it? But those are long chapters to get through in 10 minutes. They're bloody long chapters. But good on you. Yeah, I know. I figured a lot of people tune in for the discussion part and then read it for themselves. But I figured if I've got to read it, I might as well audiobook it. And then there's quite a few people that listen to the audiobook as well. And it also means that as a little product, you can pretty much just listen to the podcast if you're not participating in the subreddit. And I think there's quite a few people that subscribe and do that as well. Simply Productive says, I'm binging Lord of the Rings online. I give it 10 out of 10 because I'm a huge Tolkien fan, reading multiple books right now. I'm working on Confessions by Augustine and Gone Girl. So far, both are good. Confessions is significantly more boring than I expected. X Maurice says, I just watched Lord of the Rings for the first time ever. I'm behind on nerd cred. I just watched Star Wars for the first time a few months ago. It was an enjoyable experience. I now understand so many more memes. Oh my god, I'm so jealous that you just got to watch Lord of the Rings for the first time ever. I wish I could go back and watch it for the first time ever. What a fantastic film. That's on my list of films. I haven't watched it for probably at least a decade. And the reason I haven't watched it is because it's on my list. It's the top of my list of films to watch when I get a really good home entertainment system. Like, I've got a good TV, a decent TV, but it's not like some huge 4K, you know, HDR thing or anything like that. So, and you know, I don't have a big surround sound and all the works. So when I've got like a full home cinema kind of set up one day, that's probably the first thing I'm going to watch is the Lord of the Rings films. I'm saving it for that. I've already seen it, but I'm saving my rewatch. I do appreciate all these posts that have come through, people chit-chatting about what they're up to. I won't read them all because it's quite a lot, but I do appreciate that. The conversation has been valuable. I can't even say valuable. Valuable. How do you... Oh, my God. Day 3 of isolation and I've forgotten how words work. How do words work? Let's hop over to the chapter 6 discussion. Is Madame de Cintry proud? What is meant by all this proud talk? And why will Newman need bravery to visit them again? I was talking yesterday about, was there innuendo or euphemisms a couple of chapters back? And they were all thoughts that I had where I was like, is that? No, I don't think so. I think I read that wrong. And then I kind of like figured that I was wrong. But then I went ahead and asked anyway yesterday in the podcast. And Charlotte has responded. The description of the statue was, it was a wonderfully delicate piece of carving. And in a moment, through one of the rents of his gown, you espied a fat capon hung round the monk's waist. I'm not 100% sure what a capon is in this context. The dictionary says a castrated domestic cock fattened for eating. So did the monk literally have a rooster hanging around its waist? And if so, what was the significance of that? I confess I also wondered if it was somehow innuendo, but it doesn't really seem to fit. I think more likely the monk looked austere at first, but then you see he's planning to have a big meal later? I don't know. As for Monsieur Nioche's description of his wife and daughter, he says, but to tell you the truth, she is also a French croquette, I'm sorry to say, he added in a moment, shaking his head with a world of harmless bitternesses, that she comes honestly by it. Her mother was one before her. Google Translate says French croquette means a frank flirtatious, which doesn't seem quite right, but I think he was saying that mother and daughter both flirt too much, not that they are actual prostitutes. Okay, so I think I did read them wrong. I don't think it was a monk with its penis hanging out. And I don't think he was saying both his wife and daughter are prostitutes. Thanks for the clarification. Altreat said, I'm not entirely sure what they mean by proud, but I think it's possibly referring to the fact that she doesn't want to marry again and so is maybe too pleased by herself or too picky, has very high standards. But also, since her longtime friend, Mrs. Tristram, describes her as proud, and then talks about how she didn't actually divulge any of her troubles, she may be very private in that sense, not wanting to share what may cause others to pity her, lower her in their eyes, etc. She wants to project an image of capability, even if she is struggling. She's too proud to cry on a shoulder, or show weakness, or even desire other emotions. Acoustic Eel says, I keep reading this book as though the coronavirus is part of the setting. All these people brushing up against each other at the Louvre, 6 feet apart. Tour across Europe, including Northern Italy, you're not supposed to be on the street. Goes to Madame de Cintry's house, social distancing, and touches her hand. Wash them. Discussion question, what song does Newman sing for 20 seconds while washing his hands? Altreat says, oh man, it's got to be John Brown's Body. He's a union man, right? I just timed it. One verse is about 20 seconds. Very good. I think we've cracked it. That's the discussion part of the of the episode done. I need a tissue. Precious, precious tissue. Excuse me. I feel like I just spent about $8 using a tissue. And now, ladies and gentlemen, we will read chapter... Wait, what are we up to? 7. Where is chapter 7? Nope, that's chapter 6. I've lost my place. I'm officially lost. Alright, chapter 7. Here's hoping Not that I don't love reading to you guys. He's hoping it's a short chapter. I know it's not a short chapter. It never is. This is a book of long chapters. But I'm very tired. And I'm getting fatigued with these long chapters. I really wish they would be broken up into smaller chunks. He does these... One thing he's done in this book, which does irk me a little bit, is he does full scene changes without even a paragraph mark, you know? Usually when you have a scene change, you have a paragraph, like a you know, a space. Or at least, you know, sometimes I have those three asterisks to show it's a scene change. Or they'll skip, you know, have shorter chapters. This one, it just does it without even a paragraph mark. It's the next day he went and did this, and it's like, oh, come on. It's the next day. It's a whole different place, a different day, different setting. Put a little break in there. But he hasn't. All right, here we go. Enough complaining. Hang on, I need a sip of decaf coffee. This is going to be a bad reading, by the way, because I'm all stuffed up in my nose, hay fevery, which means it's going to be difficult for me to read properly. Here we go, chapter 7. One evening, very late, about a week after his visit to Madame de Cintry, Newman's servant brought him a card. It was that of young Madame de Bellegarde. When a few moments later he went to receive his visitor, he found him standing in the middle of his great gilded parlour and eyeing it from cornice to carpet. Madame de Bellegarde's face, it seemed to Newman, expressed a sense of lively entertainment. What the devil is he laughing at now? Our hero asked himself. But he put... Oh, it's Monsieur de Bellegarde, not Madame. I think. It just says M dot, which I think is Monsieur, so that's a guy. What the devil is he laughing at now? Our hero asked himself. But he put the question without acrimony, for he felt that Madame de Cintry's brother was a good fellow, and he had a presentiment that on this basis of good fellowship they were destined to understand each other. Only, if there was anything to laugh at, he wished to have a glimpse of it too. To begin with, said the young man, as he extended his hand, I have come too late. Too late for what? Asked Newman. To smoke a cigar with you. You would have to come early to do that, said Newman. I don't smoke. But you are a strong man. But I keep cigars, Newman added. Sit down. Surely I may not smoke here, said Monsieur de Bellegarde. What's the matter? Is this room too small? It is too large. It is like smoking in a ballroom or a church. That is what you were laughing at just now, Newman asked. The size of my room. It is not only size, replied Monsieur de Bellegarde, but splendour and harmony and beauty of detail. It was the smile of admiration. Newman looked at him a moment, and then, so it is very ugly, he inquired. Ugly, my dear sir? It is magnificent. That is the same thing, I suppose, said Newman. Make yourself comfortable. Your coming to see me, I take it, is an act of friendship. You are not obliged to. Therefore, if anything around here amuses you, it will be all in a pleasant way. Laugh as loud as you please. I like to see my visitors cheerful. Only I must make this request, that you explain the joke to me as soon as you can speak. I don't want to lose anything myself. Monsieur de Bellegarde stared with a look of unresentful perplexity. He laid his hand on Newman's sleeve and seemed on the point of saying something, but he suddenly checked himself, leaned back in his chair, and puffed at his cigar. At last, however, breaking silence, certainly, he said, my coming to see you is an act of friendship. Nevertheless, I was in a measure obliged to do so. My sister asked me to come, and a request from my sister is for me a law. I was near you, and I observed lights in what I suppose were your rooms. It was not a ceremonious hour for making a call, but I was not sorry to do something that would show I was not performing a mere ceremony. Well, here I am as large as life, said Newman, extending his legs. I don't know what you mean, the young man went on, by giving me unlimited leave to laugh. Certainly I am a great laugher, but it is better to laugh too much than too little. But it is not in order that we may laugh together or separately that I have, I may say, sought your acquaintance. To speak with almost impudent frankness, you interest me. All this was uttered by Monsieur de Bellegarde with the modulated smoothness of the man of the world, and in spite of his excellent English of the Frenchman, but Newman, at the same time that he had sat, noting its harmonious flow, perceived it was not mere mechanical urbanity. Decidedly there was something in his visitor that he liked. Monsieur de Bellegarde was a foreigner to his fingertips, and if Newman had met him on a western prairie, he would have felt it proper to address him with a "How do you do, monsieur?" But there was something in his physiognomy which seemed to cast a sort of aerial bridge over the impassable gulf produced by difference of race. He was below the middle height and robust and agile in figure. Valentin de Bellegarde, Newman afterwards learned, had a mortal dread of the robustness overtaking the agility. He was afraid of growing stout. He was too short, as he said, to afford a belly. He rode and fenced and practiced gymnastics with unremitting zeal, and if you greeted him with a "How well you are looking," he stared and turned pale. In your "well," he read a grosser monosyllable. He had a round head, high above the ears, a crop of hair at once dense and silky, a broad low forehead, a short nose, of the ironical and inquiring rather than of the dogmatic or sensitive cast, and a moustache as delicate as that of a page in a romance. He resembled his sister, not in feature, but in the expression of his clear, bright eye, completely void of introspection, and in the way he smiled. The great point in his face was that it was intensely alive, frankly, ardently, gallantly alive. The look of it was like a bell, of which the handle might have been in the young man's soul. At a touch of the handle, it rang with a loud silver sound. There was something in his quick, light brown eye which assured you that he was not economizing his consciousness. He was not living in a corner of it to spare the furniture of the rest. He was squarely encamped in the center, and he was keeping open house. When he smiled, it was like the movement of a person who is, in emptying a cup, turns it upside down. He gave you the last drop of his jollity. He inspired Newman with something of the same kindness that our hero used to feel in his earlier years for those of his companions who could perform strange and clever tricks, make their joints crack in queer places, or whistle at the back of their mouths. My sister told me, Monsieur de Bellegarde continued, that I ought to come and remove the impression that I had taken such a great pain to produce upon you, the impression that I am a lunatic. Did it strike you that I behaved very oddly the other day?
Rather so, said Newman.
So my sister tells me. And Monsieur de Bellegarde watched his host for a moment through his smoke wreaths. If that is the case, I think we had better let it stand. I didn't try to make you think I was a lunatic at all. On the contrary, I wanted to produce a favourable impression. But if, after all, I made a fool of myself, it was the intention of Providence. I should injure myself by protesting too much, for I should seem to set up a claim for wisdom which, in the sequel of our acquaintance, I could by no means justify. Set me down as a lunatic with intervals of sanity. Oh, I guess you know what you are about, said Newman. When I am sane, I am very sane, that I admit, Monsieur de Bellegarde answered. But I didn't come here to talk about myself. I should like to ask you a few questions. You allow me? Give me a specimen, said Newman. You live here alone? Absolutely. With whom should I live? For the moment, said Madame Monsieur de Bellegarde with a smile, I am asking questions, not answering them. You have come to Paris for your pleasure? Newman was silent a while, then at last said, Everyone asks me that, he said with mild slowness. It sounds so awfully foolish. But at any rate, you had a reason. Oh, I came for my pleasure, said Newman. Though it is foolish, it is true. And you are enjoying it? Like any other good American, Newman thought it was well not to truckle to the foreigner. Oh, so, he answered. Monsieur de Bellegarde puffed his cigar again in silence. For myself, he said at last, I am entirely at your service. Anything I can do for you, I shall be very happy to do. Call upon me at your convenience. Is there anyone you desire to know? Anything you wish to see? It is a pity you should not enjoy Paris. Oh, I do enjoy it, said Newman, good-naturedly. I am much obliged to you. Honestly speaking, Monsieur de Bellegarde went on, there is something absurd to me in hearing myself make you these offers. They represent a great deal of goodwill, but they represent little else. You are a successful man, and I am a failure, and it's a turning of the tables to talk as if I could lend you a hand. In what way are you a failure? Asked Newman. I am not a tragical failure, cried the young man with a laugh. I have fallen from a height, and my fiasco has made no noise. You evidently are a success. You have made a fortune. You have built up an edifice. You are a financial, commercial power. You can travel about the world until you have found a soft spot and lie down in it with the consciousness of having earned your rest. Is not that true? Well, imagine the exact reverse of all that, and you have me. I've done nothing wrong. I can do nothing wrong. Sorry, I have done nothing. I can do nothing. Why not? It's a long story. Someday I will tell you. Meanwhile, I'm right, eh? You are a success. You have made a fortune. It's none of my business, but in short, you are rich. That's another thing that it sounds foolish to say, said Newman. Hang it, no man is rich. I have heard philosophers affirm, laughed Monsieur de Bellegarde, that no man was poor, but your formula strikes me as an improvement. As a general thing, I confess I don't like successful people, and I find clever men who have made great fortunes very offensive. They tread on my toes, they make me uncomfortable. But as soon as I saw you, I said to myself, ah, there is a man with whom I shall get on. He has the good nature of success, and none of the morgue, who he has not our confoundedly irritable French vanity. In short, I took a fancy to you. We are very different, I am sure. I don't believe there is a subject on which we think or feel alike, but I rather think we shall get on, for there is such a thing, you know, as being too different to quarrel. Oh, I never quarrel, said Newman. Never. Sometimes it's a duty, or at least it's a pleasure. Oh, I have had two or three delicious quarrels in my day, said Monsieur de Bellegarde's handsome smile assuredly. And Monsieur de Bellegarde's handsome smile assumed, at the memory of these incidents, an almost voluptuous intensity. With the preamble embodied in his share of the foregoing fragment of dialogue, he paid our hero a long visit as the two men sat with their heels on Newman's glowing hearth. They heard the small hours of the morning striking larger from a far-off belfry. Valentin de Bellegarde was, by his own confession, at all times a great chatterer, and on this occasion he was evidently in the particularly loquacious mood. It was a tradition of his race that people of its blood always conferred a favour by their smiles, and as his enthusiasms were as rare as his civility was constant, he had a double reason for not suspecting that his friendship could ever be importunate. Moreover, the flower of an ancient stem as he was, tradition, since I have used the word, had in its temperament nothing of disagreeable rigidity. It was muffled in sociability and urbanity, as an old dowager in her laces and strings of pearls. Valentin was what is called in France, a gentilhomme of the purest source, and his rule of life, so far as it was definite, was to play the part of a gentilhomme. This, it seemed to him, was enough to occupy comfortably a young man of ordinary good parts. But all that he was by instinct and not by theory, and the amiability of his character was so great and certain of the aristocratic virtues, which in some aspects seem rather brittle and trenchant, acquired in his application of them an extreme geniality. In his younger years, he had been suspected of low tastes, and his mother had greatly feared he would make a slip in the mud of the highway and bespatter the family shield. He had been treated, therefore, to more than his share of schooling and drilling, but his instructors had not succeeded in mounting him upon stilts. They could not spoil his safe spontaneity, and he remained the least cautious and the most lucky of young nobles. He had been tied with so short a rope in his youth that he had now a mortal grudge against family discipline. He had been known to say, within the limits of the family, that, light-headed as he was, the honour of the name was safer in his hands than in those of some of its other members, and that if a day ever came to try it, they should see. His talk was an odd mixture of almost boyish garrulity and of the reserve and discretion of the man of the world, and he seemed to Newman, as afterwards young members of the Latin races often seemed to him, now amusingly juvenile and now appallingly mature. In America, Newman reflected, lads of 25 and 30 have old heads and young hearts, or at least young morals. Here they have young heads and very aged hearts, morals, and the most grizzled and wrinkled. What I envy you is your liberty, observed Monsieur de Bellegarde, your wide range, your freedom to come and go. You're not having a lot of people who take themselves awfully seriously expecting something of you. I live, he added with a sigh, beneath the eyes of my admirable mother. It is your own fault. What is it to hinder your ranging? Said Newman. There is a delightful simplicity in that remark. Everything is to hinder me. To begin with, I have not a penny. I had not a penny when I began to range. Ah, but your poverty was your capital. Being an American, it was impossible you should remain what you were born, and being born poor, do I understand it, it was therefore inevitable that you should become rich. You are in a position that makes one's mouth water. You looked round and you saw a world full of things you had only to step up and take hold of. When I was 20, I looked around me and I saw a world with everything ticketed, hands off, and the juice of it was that the ticket seemed meant only for me. I couldn't go into business. I couldn't make money because I was a Bellegarde. I couldn't go into politics because I was a Bellegarde. The Bellegardes don't recognize the Bonapartes. I couldn't go into literature because I was a dunce. I couldn't marry a rich girl because no Bellegarde had ever married a roturier, and it was not proper that I should begin. We shall have to come to it yet. Marriageable heiresses, dear Notre Board, are not to be had for nothing. It must be name for name and fortune for fortune. The only thing I could do was to go and fight for the Pope, and that I did punctiliously, and received an apostolic flesh wound at Castelfidardo. It did neither the Holy Father nor me any good that I could see. Rome was doubtless a very amusing place in the days of Caligula, but it has sadly fallen off since. I passed 3 years in the castle of St. Angelo and then came back to secular life. So you have no profession, you do nothing, said Newman. I do nothing. I am supposed to amuse myself, and to tell you the truth, I have amused myself. One can, if one only knows. But you can't keep it up forever. I am good for another 5 years, perhaps, but I foresee that after that I shall lose my appetite. Then what shall I do? I think I shall turn monk. Seriously, I think I shall tie a rope around my waist and go into a monastery. It was an old custom, and the old customs were very good. People understood life quite as well as we do. They kept the pot boiling till it cracked, and then they put it on the shelf altogether. Are you very religious? Asked Newman, in a tone which gave the inquiry a grotesque effect. Monsieur de Bellegarde evidently appreciated the comical element in the question, but he looked at Newman a moment with extreme soberness. I am a very good Catholic. I respect the Church. I adore the Blessed Virgin. I fear the devil. Well then, said Newman, you are very well fixed. You have got pleasure in the present and religion in the future. What do you complain of? It's a part of one's pleasure to complain. There is something in your own circumstances that irritates me. You are the first man I have ever envied. It's singular, but so it is. I have known many men who, besides any factitious advantages that I may possess, had money and brains into the bargain. But somehow they have never disturbed my good humour. But you have got something that I should have liked to have. It is not money. It is not even brains, though no doubt yours are excellent. It is not your 6 feet of height, though I should have rather liked to be a couple of inches taller. It's a sort of air you have of being thoroughly at home in the world. When I was a boy, my father told me that it was by such an air as that that people recognized a Bellegarde. He called my attention to it. He didn't advise me to cultivate it. He said that as we grew up, it always came of itself. I suppose it had come to me, because I think I have always had the feeling. My place in life was made for me, and it seemed easy to occupy it. But you, who, as I understand, have made your own place, you, who, as you told us the other day, have manufactured washtubs, you strike me somehow as a man who stands at his ease, who looks at things from a height. I fancy you going about the world like a man travelling on a railroad in which he owns a large amount of stock. You make me feel as if I have missed something. What is it? It is the proud consciousness of honest toil, of having manufactured a few washtubs, said Newman, at once jocose and serious. Oh no, I have seen men who have done even more, men who have made not only washtubs, but soap, strong-smelling yellow soap in great bars, and they never made me at the least uncomfortable. Then it's the privilege of being an American citizen, said Newman, that sets a man up. Possibly, rejoined Monsieur de Bellegarde, but I am forced to say that I have seen a great many American citizens who didn't seem at all set up, or in the least like large stockholders. I never envied them. I rather think the thing is an accomplishment of your own. Oh, come, said Newman, you will make me proud. No, I shall not. You have nothing to do with pride, or with humility. That is a part of this easy manner of yours. People are proud only when they have something to lose, and humble when they have something to gain. I don't know what I have to lose, said Newman, but I certainly have something to gain. What is it? Asked his visitor. Newman hesitated a while. I will tell you when I know you better. I hope that will be soon. Then, if I can help you to gain it, I shall be happy. Perhaps you may, said Newman. Don't forget, then, that I am your servant, said Monsieur de Bellegarde, answered. Don't forget, that I am your servant, Monsieur de Bellegarde answered, and shortly afterwards he took his departure. During the next 3 weeks, Newman saw Bellegarde several times, and without formally swearing an eternal friendship, the two men established a sort of comradeship. To Newman, Bellegarde was the ideal Frenchman, the Frenchman of tradition and romance. So far as our hero was concerned with these mystical influences, gallant, expansive, amusing, more pleased himself with the effect he produced than those, even when they were all well pleased. For whom he produced it, a master of all the distinctively social virtues, and a votary of all agreeable sensations, a devotee of something mysterious and sacred to which he occasionally alluded in terms more ecstatic than those in which he spoke of the last pretty woman, and which he was simply the beautiful, though somewhat superannuated, image of honour. He was irresistibly entertaining and enlivening, and he formed a character to which Newman was as capable of doing justice when he had once been placed in contact with it as he was unlikely. In musing upon the possible mixtures of our human ingredients, mentally to have foreshadowed it, Bellegarde did not in the least cause him to modify his needful premise that all Frenchmen are of a frothy and imponderable substance. He simply reminded him that light materials may be beaten up into a most agreeable compound. No two companions could be more different, but their differences made a capital basis for a friendship of which the distinctive characteristic was that it was extremely amusing to each. Valentin de Bellegarde lived in the basement of an old house in Rue d'Ajoux, Saint-Honoré, and his small apartments lay between the court of the house and an old garden which spread itself behind it, one of those large, sunless, humid gardens into which you look unexpectedly in Paris from back windows, wondering how among the grudging habitations they find their space. When Newman returned Bellegarde's visit, he hinted that his lodgings was at least as much a laughing matter as his own, but its oddities were of a different cast from those of our hero's gilded saloons and, on the boulevard, housemen. The place was low, dusky, contracted, and crowded with curious bric-a-brac. Bellegarde, penniless patrician as he was an insatiable collector, and his walls were covered with rusty arms and ancient panels and pallets and platters. His doorways draped in faded tapestries, his floors muffled in the skins of beasts. Here and there was one of those uncomfortable tributes to elegance in which the upholsterer's art in France is so prolific, a curtain recess with a sheet of looking glass in which among the shadows you could see nothing, a divan on which, for its festoons and furbelows, you could not sit, a fireplace draped, flounced, and frilled to the complete exclusion of fire. The young man's possessions were in picturesque disorder, and his apartment was pervaded by the odour of cigars, mingled with perfumes more inscrutable. Newman thought it a damp, gloomy place to live in, and was puzzled by the obstructive and fragmentary character of the furniture. Bellegarde, according to the custom of his country, talked very generously about himself and unveiled the mysteries of his private history with an unsparing hand. Inevitably, he had a vast deal to say about women, and he used frequently to indulge in sentimental and ironical apostrophes to these authors of his joys and woes. "Oh, the women, and the things they have made me do," he would exclaim with a lustrous eye. "C'est égal. Of all the follies and stupidities I have committed for them, I would not have missed one." On this subject, Newman maintained an habitual reserve to expatiate largely upon it had always seemed to him a proceeding vaguely analogous to the cooing of pigeons and the chattering of monkeys, and even inconsistent with a fully developed human character. But Bellegarde's confidence has greatly amused him and rarely displeased him, for the generous young Frenchman was not a cynic. I really think, he had once said, that I am not more depraved than most of my contemporaries. They are tolerably depraved, my contemporaries. He said wonderfully pretty things about his female friends, and numerous and various as they had been, declared that, on the whole, there was more good in them than harm. But you are not to take that as advice, he added. As an authority, I am very untrustworthy. I am prejudiced in their favour. I am an idealist. Newman listened to him with his impartial smile and was glad for his sake that he had had fine feelings, but he mentally repudiated the idea of a Frenchman having discovered any merit in the amiable sex which he himself did not suspect. Monsieur de Bellegarde, however, did not confine his conversation to the autobiographical channel. He questioned our hero largely as to the events of his own life, and Newman told him some better stories than any that Bellegarde carried on his budget. He narrated his career, in fact, from the beginning through all its variations, and whenever his companion's credulity or his habits of gentility appeared to protest, it amused him to heighten the colour of the episode. Newman had sat with Western humorists in knots around cast-iron stoves and seen tall stories grow taller without toppling over, and his own imagination had learned the trick of piling up consistent wonders. Bellegarde's regular attitude at last became that of laughing self-defence to maintain his reputation as all-knowing Frenchman. He doubted of everything wholesale. The result of this was that Newman found it impossible to convince him of certain time-honoured verities. But the details don't matter, said Monsieur de Bellegarde. You have evidently had some surprising adventures. You have seen some strange sides of life. You have revolved to and fro over a whole continent as I walked up and down the boulevard. You are a man of the world with a vengeance. You have spent some deadly dull hours. You have done some extremely disagreeable things. You have shoveled sand as a boy for supper, and you have eaten roast dog in a gold digger's camp. You have stood casting up figures for 10 hours at a time, and you have sat through Methodist sermons for the sake of looking at a pretty girl in another pew. All that is rather stiff, as we say, but at any rate you have done something, and you are something. You have used your will, and you have made your fortune. You have not stupefied yourself with debauchery, and you have not mortgaged your fortune to social conveniences. You take things easily, and you have fewer prejudices even than I, who pretend to have none, but you in reality have 3 or 4. Happy man, you are strong, and you are free. But what the deuce, demanded the young man in conclusion, do you propose to do with such advantages? Really, to use them, you need a better world than this. There is nothing worth your while here. Oh, I think there is something, said Newman. What is it? Murmured Newman. What is it? Well, murmured Newman, I will tell you some other time. In this way our hero delayed from day to day, broaching a subject which he had very much at heart. Meanwhile, however, he was growing practically familiar with it. In other words, he had called again 3 times on Madame de Cintry. On only 2 of these occasions he had found her at home, and on each of them she had other visitors. Her visitors were numerous and extremely loquacious, and they exacted much of their hostess's attention. She found time, however, to bestow a little of it on Newman, in an occasional vague smile, the very vagueness of which pleased him, allowing him, as it did, to fill it out mentally, both at the time and afterwards, with such meanings as most pleased him. He sat by without speaking, looking at the entrances and exits, the greetings and chatterings of Madame de Cintry's visitors. He felt as if he were at the play, as if his own speaking would be an interruption. Sometimes he wished he had a book to follow the dialogue. He half expected to see a woman in a white cap and a pink ribbon come and offer him 1 or 2 francs. Some of the ladies looked at him very hard or very soft, as you please. Others seemed profoundly unconscious of his presence. The men looked only at Madame de Cintry. This was inevitable, for whether one called her beautiful or not, she entirely occupied and filled one's vision, just as an agreeable sound fills one's ear. Newman had but 20 distinct words with her, but he carried away an impression to which solemn promises could not have given a higher value. She was part of the play that he was seeing acted, quite as much as her companions, but how she filled the stage and how much better she did it. Whether she rose or seated herself, whether she went with her departing friends to the door and lifted up the heavy curtain as they passed out and stood an instant, looking after them and giving them the last nod, or whether she leaned back in her chair with her arms crossed and her eyes resting, listening and smiling, she gave Newman the feeling that he should like to have her always before him, moving slowly to and fro along the whole scale of expressive hospitality. If it might be to him, it would be well. If it might be for him, it would be still better. She was so tall and yet so light, so active and yet so still, so elegant, yet so simple, so frank and yet so mysterious. It was the mystery. It was that what she was off the stage, as if it were, that interested Newman most of all. He could not have told you what warrant he had for talking about mysteries. If it had been his habit to express himself in poetic figures, he might have said that in observing Madame de Cintry, he seemed to see the vague circle which sometimes accompanies the partly filled disk of the moon. It was not that she was reserved. On the contrary, she was frank as flowing water, but she was sure she had qualities which she herself did not suspect. He had abstained for several reasons from saying some of these things to Bellegarde. One reason was that before proceeding to any act, he was always circumspect, conjectural, contemplative. He had little eagerness, as became a man who felt that whenever he really began to move, he walked with long steps, and then it simply pleased him not to speak. It occupied him, it excited him. But one day Bellegarde had been dining with him at a restaurant, and they had sat long over their dinner. On rising from it, Bellegarde proposed that, to help them through the rest of the evening, they should go and see Madame Dandelard. Madame Dandelard was a little Italian lady who had married a Frenchman, who proved to be a rake and a brute and the torment of her life. Her husband spent all her money, and then, lacking the means of obtaining more expensive pleasures, had taken in his duller hours to beating her. She had a blue spot somewhere, which she showed to several persons, including Bellegarde. She had obtained a separation from her husband, collected the scraps of her fortune, they were very meagre, and come to live in Paris, where she was staying at a Hotel Garni. She was always looking for an apartment and visiting inquiringly those of other people. She was very pretty, very childlike, and she made very extraordinary remarks. Bellegarde had made her acquaintance, and the source of his interest in her was, according to his own declaration, a curiosity as to what would become of her. "She is poor, she is pretty, and she is silly," he said. "It seems to me she can only go one way. It's a pity, but it can't be helped. I will give her 6 months. She has nothing to fear from me, but I am watching the process. I'm curious to see just how things will go. Yes, I know what you are going to say. This horrible Paris hardens one's heart, but it quickens one's wits, and ends by teaching one refinement of observation. To see this little woman's little drama play itself out now is for me an intellectual pleasure." "If she is going to throw herself away," Newman had said, "you ought to stop her." "Stop her? Stop her how?" "Talk to her. Give her some good advice." Bellegarde laughed. "Heaven deliver us both. Imagine the situation. Go and advise her yourself." It was after this that Newman had gone with Bellegarde to see Madame Dandelard. When they came away, Bellegarde reproached his companion. "Where was your famous advice?" he asked. "I didn't hear a word of it." "Oh, I give it up," said Newman simply. "Then you are as bad as I," said Bellegarde. "No, because I don't take an intellectual pleasure in her prospective adventures. I don't in the least want to see her going downhill. I had rather look the other way." "But why," he asked in a moment, "don't you get your sister to go and see her?" Bellegarde stared. "Go and see Madame Dandelard, my sister? She might talk to her to very good purpose." Bellegarde shook his head with sudden gravity. "My sister can't see that sort of person. Madame Dandelard is nothing at all. They would never meet." "I should think," said Newman, "that your sister might see whom she pleased." And he privately resolved that after he knew her a little better, he would ask Madame de Cintry to go and talk to the foolish little Italian lady. After his dinner with Bellegarde, on the occasion I have mentioned, he demurred to his companion's proposal that they should go again and listen to Madame Dandelard describe her sorrows and her bruises. "I have something better in mind," he said. "Come home with me and finish the evening before my fire." Bellegarde always welcomed the prospect of a long stretch of conversation, and before long the two men sat watching the great blaze with scattered which scattered its scintillations over the high adornment of Newman's ballroom. All right, there we go. Another chapter down. Newman and what's his name? What's his name? Belgard? Besties, hey? Have your say about that one over on the subreddit. Thank you very much for listening. I will see you tomorrow.